Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
Oh, happy Friday, everybody. Yes, it is that moment in the week when we sort of sum it all up with our guys, Bill McCosh in studio.
Here I am.
2 weeks in a row, that's a good trend. And now out of studio for the first time in I don't know how long, many, many, many weeks, I think. Joe Zepecki on the road. Where are you, Joe Zepecki?
This morning finds me in Marinette.
Ah.
Marinette. Beautiful Marinettes, yeah. I like it up there.
Are you building ships today, Joe?
Not today, but we've covered a lot of ground between Lake Mills, Madison, Marshfield, Rothschild, Merrill, Chippewa Falls, Superior, and Washburn.
3 weeks to go.
Since Tuesday.
I hope you spent money in Superior.
I did.
Did you get an anchor burger?
No, did not have time for that.
All right, let's get to it. So yesterday was like Elon Musk's last day. Are we missing Musk already?
Was it yesterday or is it today? There's a press conference with him and the president at 1:30.
It's been a slow burn for a couple weeks, Eastern. I feel like.
So Elon Musk had a termed employment that lasted 130 days, and that time has come. I'd say a couple things about the process. I think he highlighted things that a lot of people thought were going on with the government, but couldn't prove it. He and his team have unearthed, you know, $1 trillion of unnecessary spending, and Joe and I are, well, maybe all of us will disagree on that. I think where he was surprised was the pushback he got from the public, particularly on his other business ventures like Tesla. I don't think he expected that. I mean, the truth is politics is a contact sport. It always has been, always will be. And, you know, my hope is that other people like him, male, female, doesn't matter, that are willing to give the government some of their expertise for a period of time that can be very helpful to all Americans, won't see this as a reason not to do it because of what they saw him go through, and will be willing to come in and help.
I've been spending a lot of time reading about Doge and people like Elon Musk. And one of the things that I think I'm going to give you credit for is there's a point of view that maybe I missed, and that's to really accomplish something, you sometimes have to come in with a hatchet.
Yeah.
And while that is painful and awkward and sometimes counterproductive, that might be the wake-up call or the shock to the system, shock and awe, as you said during the campaign.
Yeah.
That maybe could produce a formula to actually look at government inefficiencies in a different way. That maybe is the point of Elon Musk.
Yeah, and I know we're going to get to Doge in the next segment, but as it relates to Musk's, you know, accomplishments, I think they're pretty extraordinary. Just even the outlining of these things. I know he's frustrated that none of it has passed, but the truth is none of those things can be funded as long as Donald Trump's president either. So even if the appropriation sits there, it will sit there without any, it won't get released. So there's some benefit to taxpayers for sure, but it's not a direct benefit. But I think it's important. I think where they missed a couple steps is being more transparent. I know they had their own website. I know they had a couple, you know, national interviews with him and the team, but they could have done more of that. I think, you know, sending out a press release a day or a week or a couple a day, at some points it seemed like there were five or six a day, is too much information at one time. And I'm not sure the public totally grasped what they were able to accomplish or unearth. And I think history is going to be good to Elon Musk for his service to the country. And, you know, I hope we haven't heard or seen the last of him. And I know we haven't on the private side. And, you know, hopefully he gets us to Mars.
All right, Joe, weigh in. Your opinion of Elon Musk and his Doge efforts.
It's like we're living in a different world. A drug-addled billionaire, unaccountable to anyone, was allowed to run amok throughout government, overpromised, underdelivered, and literally was apparently on drugs the whole time. The New York Times this morning, Mr. Musk's drug consumption went well beyond occasional use. He told people he was taking so much ketamine that it was affecting his bladder. He took ecstasy and psychedelic mushrooms, traveled with a daily medication box that held about 20 pills, including ones with the markings of the stimulant Adderall, according to a photo of the box. This was madness from jump. And if it had gone to the public for accountability nationwide, it would have gone about as well for him as it did in Wisconsin, where he tried to win an election by just opening up the checkbook and got roundly rejected. So I can't wait to talk about the Doge scorecard, because it is not good. And we apparently don't care if people on drugs are working for the public. I thought we did.
Bill?
I think he's being a little selective if we're going to talk about drug use here. But I don't care what
does that even mean?
Well, you guys jumped me when I brought it up when it revolved around Zelensky, and you're doing the same thing here. So I don't think that matters. I think what matters is what he did to identify excessive or fraudulent, in many cases,
but
spending.
But what was it? Like, I feel like there still hasn't been any charges made for any fraudulent, anyone who did anything wrong. Like, that's the thing. Like, there's also all these legal battles that are still could undo what he did. But I'm saying, like, and maybe you're right. Maybe
it's a fair question.
The messaging wasn't there. But I also don't know, like, what was actually legally broke. Like, what was
he
broken?
He has said, and others have said, that there are cases before DOJ. There are two things that deeply frustrate conservatives. One is that the Congress hasn't acted on these cuts yet. We'll get to that in the next segment. The other is, where are we at with DOJ? DOJ has been a D at best so far.
Gambandi not getting it done?
She's not getting it done, in my opinion.
So you're saying there's cases we don't know about.
Correct.
Over fraud.
Yes.
That are under, like, wrap.
Under investigation, and the indictments are forthcoming.
Okay.
I said this on Twitter, on our text exchange. Ultimately, the cider, the arbiter of what Doge and Musk accomplished will not be the administration. It will not be Elon Musk. It'll be journalists, real journalists, who are looking at this maybe years later and saying, this is what happened as a result of this. And maybe it's nothing. I don't know. To Joe's point, maybe it's nothing. I think there's something there. We're going to find out what that something is. Lots more to get to on this Friday edition of Point Taken. She's Kristen. I'm Steve. Bill McCashin. Joe on the road. That is Joe Sapecki. Lots more after this on 620 WTMJ. Oh, yeah. Winding it up with Bill McCosh and Joseph Peck and Kristen Bryce. This video on this Friday, Point Taken, is the name of the show. You can find us not only over the air, but online, on YouTube, and we actually have audio and video of Mr. Zepecki, who's traveling the great state of Wisconsin.
You text WATCH to 855-616-1620. You can weigh in on what color Joe Zepecki's shirt is. Is that a salmon color that you're wearing today, Joe?
I think we should let the listeners and watchers guess, and then I'll
divulge. Is it an orange sherbet?
I can't see, but salmon isn't going to play in Marinette, brother. I can tell you, north of 29, that's not going to fly.
Put a black T-shirt on. All right, so we could talk about Doge, you can talk about Elon Musk all day, but Congress has a role to play, and codifying what apparently they found and are trying to accomplish in our governments is important. And I would say, and I've had an argument with many conservatives about this, I don't think Congress is doing their job.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I've got the report card right here.
You want to start? Go
ahead.
All
right, go ahead, Joe.
If I may. So Mr. Musk said he was going to find $2 trillion to cut out of government. At the end of his tenure, which is today, they are claiming to have found $175 billion. That is 8.75% of the original goal. That is a fail. And we now have every House Republican but one has voted for a bill that will add $3.8 trillion in deficit spending. It is such an abomination. Even Elon Musk has come out against this bill. So how can you say by any measure that this was a successful use of anyone's time?
Well, the number I'm aware of is $880 billion that they've saved. And by the way, any savings is a success. It's not a fail. When's the last time the government cut any spending of any kind? So that it is a success that way. As it relates to the scoring, I wouldn't worry too much about the House bill because that's not the final one that's going to pass. They cut $1.6 trillion in actual spending, the largest in 30 years. That isn't getting through the Senate. My guess is the Senate will be closer to $2 trillion, maybe $2.5 trillion, which I'm totally here for. So the bill will get better for conservatives as they move forward. As it relates to these Doge cuts, though, I think it's important to sort of track this week. Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, was the first guy who called it out. I can't remember if it was on Monday or Tuesday, but he basically said, hey, you guys, wake up and do your job. The next day, Trump said something about it. Then Musk said something about it. And, oh, by the way, now the House is going to take up these rescission packages, is what they're called, for the Doge cuts starting next week. I'm going to make a prediction here. All of the cuts will pass the House. I'm not sure any of them will pass the Senate because they're different rules. Now we have the filibuster rule they have to contend with. The reason these are not tucked into the big, beautiful bill is they can't be. These are discretionary spending. Those no discretionary spending monies can be dealt with in a reconciliation bill. There's different rules. So they have to go through normal order, which means in the Senate they have to have 60 votes. I'm not sure they're going to get 60 votes, but I can tell you this. Any Republican of the 53 who votes against any of those rescission packages, you better watch your backside because a primary is coming.
Real quick on the big, beautiful budget bill. I know it's sort of a little bit off topic, but they've talked about getting this done by July 4th. Is that realistic, do you think?
It still is today. We'll see over the course of the next couple of weeks. I mean, these guys get so much vacation, it's unbelievable. But they're finally getting back to work again next week. We'll see how close they can get over the next 2 weeks. First, you got to pass something through the Senate. So they have a position that only takes 50 plus the vice president. And then you have to have a conference committee vote in both houses. So can that all be done in 30 days? I hope so. We'll see.
But you're saying history will be on the Musk did a good job side.
I think it will. Yeah, I think most people who voted for Trump, if not all of them, say they did what they said they were going to do. They campaigned on this Doge idea. Honest to God, in December and January, Republican lawmakers were falling all over themselves trying to be part of the Doge caucus. Where are those voices now? I mean, they have no idea what's coming from Republican voters next August or whenever their primaries are if they do nothing on these things. This is the scorecard that GOP or Trump voters are looking at.
Just for what it's worth, if you go to doge.muskwatch.com, it will itemize everything that they have claimed, that the itemized cuts, and then what's actually been verifiable. So the claimed cuts are $165 billion. The Doge itemized cuts is $69 billion. And the verifiable canceled funding is $16.3 billion.
All wins.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny that we just treat $16 billion like nothing.
Right. No, I know, oh, but it's different than what. And well, we got to go to a break, but I actually, well, TBD on what we're going to do next because I don't know if we should move on or not, but there's more questions
time.
I have.
Got lots of time.
All right, stay with us on Point Taken.
All right, little time before the bottom of the hour news with Connie Weber, and for you kids out there, you youngsters, that's 10:30.
Does that joke ever get old for you?
No. Just like hump days never going to get old for me because I think it's funny. And
think it's funny.
I'll laugh forever on that one. Are you at a follow-up question?
I posed this to Steve as far as in his, him being Elon Musk, in his exit interview tour that he's doing, obviously interview with the Washington Post, he alluded to how much harder cutting $2 trillion, which was his original promise or estimate, ended up being, but he didn't go into why that was hard. And my question is it because there isn't enough to cut without a lot of damage? Is it because of red tape? Like, what got in his way? Because it kind of, he just barnstormed the federal government. So what got in his way from doing more?
So my guess on this is that he realized that this is all being done in public. If he were doing this in one of his companies, or if any other major CEO were doing this, you're doing it behind closed doors, right? You're cutting as much as you can possibly cut to let the company continue to operate and then turn itself around and then grow. In government, you can't do that. I mean, I said it last week. I'm going to say it till this bill's done. I mean, both sides are allergic to spending cuts. Allergic. And they don't like to do it. It's much easier to spend money and keep constituencies happy than it is to tell them, sorry, you know, that program sort of run its course. It is the biggest negative in politics, in my opinion, and it's on both sides.
And here's where I got to give credit to Senator Ron Johnson, because he's steadfast in saying, I'm not going to vote for this because it's not reducing the federal deficit. And until we start taking that seriously, Nothing's going
to
happen.
So to his credit, his actual words is he's not voting for this version. Ron Johnson will be a yes on this bill, and there will be significantly more spending cuts in here.
You think it's going to be more spending cuts
yes.
out of the Senate
yes.
than what the House put forward?
I do.
Yeah.
And where do you think it's going to come from?
Salt. Salt will be the first place.
Okay. Joe, do you have
probably right.
thoughts on this?
I can finally hear myself and you guys without an echo, so my brain is resetting.
Great.
The shirt is orange, by the way.
All right. Oh. There you go.
That works up north.
Yeah.
Actually, you gotta wear all orange up north. You fit in
yeah,
that.
Yeah, there you go.
Bill, is your shirt from Untuck It? I believe I have the same one.
It is. All right. Enough of the promotion stuff. Let's go. You got a minute.
You got a minute, Joe.
I literally don't even know what the question is.
Oh, okay. Right. All right. Well, when we come back, there's been a little ping pong happening in international trade courts.
Oh, my God.
And
every
so
day.
It now feels like the tariffs are back on?
They're on.
For now?
They're on.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about what that means, but also just the fact of what is it like to be someone who watches the market right now, someone who works in finance, because between a Truth Social tweet, what the courts are doing, any other kind of random thing that throws the market into haywire, it's a very uncertain time, to say the least.
Have you seen
it's
the
taco time?
Yeah,
taco time.
We're going to get to that at some point. Have you seen the length of some of the Truth Social posts now? They're like paragraph after paragraph. He used to be sort of brief and concise. President spent a lot of time just jabbering away on Truth Social. You think he's wound up? I think that taco thing hit him hard. We'll get to that at some point in the show today. Right, we got Bill in studio. Joe's on the road in, Marinette.
And he can hear us now.
He can hear us. He's got an orange shirt on, and apparently Bill's promoting untucked shirts now on the show. Lots to get to.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. He is Steve Scafidi, and it is Friday, which can only mean that Bill McCashin and Joe Zepecki are with us for our political power hour. And it is only an hour today, unfortunately. We have no overtime.
No overtime? Joe, are you advancing Sean Duffy's road trip? Is that what you're doing?
I am not, but I did notice that Secretary Duffy got in a little trouble this week, perhaps, weighing in on a Republican primary that he did not clear with the White House.
Ooh.
So all is not well. On the
I didn't see
side.
That.
Wait, what happened?
No, there's discipline in this White House coming from the great
he is
Susie Wiles.
Supporting and trying to help fundraise for Bill Huizenga, who's running for the Senate in Michigan, and he did not clear that with the boss.
Hmm. Ouch.
Well.
Yeah.
As they say.
All right.
I might be with him on that. I'm not for Rodgers. I don't like the idea of keeping running guys that have lost. I think that's a bad strategy.
All right, gentlemen.
I was going to say, this is...
Tariffs.
Tariffs.
Tariffs and court.
And the courts, because ultimately they're going to decide, and we'll see if the Trump administration, if the Supreme Court doesn't go his way, we'll listen to that. But, and I can tell you, we had an import-exporter on the show a couple weeks ago, I did, and I think it's causing chaos when we don't know what the rules are. And this back and forth on tariffs is absolutely insane. Bill.
So I have been in politics, mostly state, to be fair, for 40 years. Until this week, I didn't know there was an international trade court. So it appears, I've had to do a lot of research for this segment, that the Trump administration chose this particular path because it provided the most flexibility as it relates to tariffs. But it's not the only path. So this International Trade Court unanimously, three-judge panel, said Trump went too far on his eye for an eye tariffs, meaning reciprocal tariffs. Okay. The next day, that night, Trump's people appealed it. The next day, an appellate court said, we're going to stay this order. They didn't reverse it, but the tariffs are still in place while the case is being considered. So they're not reversed. But the other path for Trump to go, should he lose this appeal, is he does have significant powers that were granted to him by the Congress or previous Congresses, not directly to him, but previous administrations, that may limit his ability on tariffs that they could only last for 150 days.
There's like several of these, and they're very technically written.
So what I don't like about it is it does impact the market from day to day. And they call them panicins in D.C., but you got to understand people that are nearing retirement are looking at their accounts. And in April, it sucked. It was pretty bad. But in May, it's really good. And in June, the hope is it's going to be better. But now we have this thing with China today. So
is it really good, or is it just back to where it was in March?
It is slightly above where it was in March. Yeah. So it's now heading in the right direction.
All right, Zepecki, on tariffs. Go ahead.
This, to me, gets to the defining question of the Trump administration, which is the use of emergency powers claimed by the executive branch. So we're all smart enough to understand, like, if everything's an emergency, nothing's an emergency, right?
Yeah, and, because we lived through it in COVID.
Right, and we have vested in the President of the United States extraordinary emergency powers. What this administration has done, which is unusual, is on both the border and on international trade, claimed emergencies are happening, and therefore the president is empowered to use emergency powers. On the border stuff, you are saying, well, it's an emergency, we're going to invoke the Alien Enemies Act because this is an invasion, and the courts are saying, hold on, no, it's not. You can say there's a crisis at the border, you can say, but there's a technical definition of emergency. Similarly, with the tariffs, he is claiming that there is an emergency and taking for himself emergency powers. What my reading of that international trade court's ruling was, is this does not meet the definition of emergency, so you don't get to use the extra special super duper presidential powers. It is very clear, and like, this is not just a Trump thing. Bill and I agree on
this. We do.
Over the sweep of history, right, the executive branch has become more powerful, has taken more authorities, and the congressional, you know, the legislative branch has had fewer. What strikes me as happening right now is the Trump administration is trying to push that line of executive authority further through claiming, you know, emergency powers. And that is where there is the potential for a real crisis between the courts and the legislature and the executive branch. And I don't know how that's going to play out. None of us do. But that is what's happening. They're pushing the boundaries.
That's exactly the right point. It's the defining what an emergency is, because that language is written into all those different places where Trump can lean on that, his administration. That's going to be the question that the courts, the highest court, will have to answer. All right, after the break, was it weekend at Bernie's or business as usual in the Biden White House? That's next on Point Taken.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen, he's Steve, and we are here with Bill McCashin and Joe Zepecki, who is on location. All right, so congressional Republicans are now ramping up efforts to investigate the Biden administration and what staffers knew about Joe Biden's health and mental decline while he was in office. So a group of Republicans in the House introduced legislation on Thursday to create a new select committee to probe whether the Biden administration covered up signs of the former president's decline. Joe, have you read Original Sin yet?
I have not. I've been a little busy.
Yes, you
these
have.
Last few weeks.
But do you, how worried are you about this? And who do you think was actually in charge if Biden was not?
I'm not that worried about it. Presidents do things all the time by executive order that they don't go out and talk about. That is the choices of governing, right? This uproar over, oh, the auto pen was governing. Who was controlling the auto pen? When you are the executive, you sign a bunch of executive orders, and then you make choices from a communication standpoint, a strategy standpoint, about which ones you make your message of the day or your message of the week. How do we know this? Donald Trump has not said a word publicly about bringing Palantir into government as a result of an executive order he signed to do data work on Americans. Does that mean that Donald Trump isn't the president and they're covering up some big... No, you make choices. And so the reporting looks very bad for Biden and the people around him, and they have to answer for that. And if Republicans want to spend time looking backward and exploding the deficit, like, that's the choice they're making. I don't think it's a particularly good political one, but it's not my job to give them political advice.
The book Original Sin makes the claim that there's a group of people around the president, Joe Biden, including his wife, First Lady Jill Biden, Mike Donilon, Steve Ricchetti, Bruce Reed. Do you ever meet any of these people? Because some have been around Biden for a long time in his you know, sphere of influence.
I met the entire Biden family in December of 2007 when Joe and Chris, my boss Chris Dodd, were running for president.
Hmm.
So that was a long time ago.
All right. Well, I had conversations with Joe Biden, then vice president, in the 2012, 2013 timeframe, and that Joe Biden was with it, and he could carry a room for an hour if he wanted to, uninterrupted, without any notes. That's not what we saw at the end of this last administration. So as someone who's not a Democrat and never voted for Joe Biden, I am concerned that we potentially had a situation, Joe, and I ask this in all seriousness, where a president of the United States wasn't up to functioning in all the ways that a president has to function, cognitively, physically, and it was covered up. That's not a good story. There's a, what was the movie made about? Was it Dave? About the president who had, they had a look-alike president?
Yeah.
Great movie, by the way.
Awesome.
I've never even heard of this movie.
This will come out. I think, as we all understand, the first draft of history is always revised later and updated. Listen, my candid assessment of this is that the greatest sin of Joe Biden and the people around him was not that he was too old. It's that for 4 years, he was incapable of communicating with the American people, his agenda, his priorities, and what he was doing. We abdicated the bully pulpit. And if the people around Joe Biden, you know, bear guilt for that or overdid it, like, that upsets me greatly. And I don't think it rises to the level of some kind of crime.
I think the notion of congressional investigations has sort of lost its way. This isn't the 70s. This isn't Watergate. I've seen Democratic Congresses, Republican Congresses, you know, have all this fanfare about investigations that end up nowhere.
And so look at the January 6th. Right?
I don't think that's their role. Here, I'm going to get to this really quick. I think Congress's role is to update the ethics laws. And I'm going to give you a very specific example. One of Joe Biden's top aides is a woman by the name of Anita Dunn. For some reason, there is a loophole in the ethics laws in D.C. where you can actually work in the White House. You can be a senior advisor to the President of the United States and not disclose a single thing about any of your investments as long as you make less than $132,000. And oh, by the way, the investment she had, she is a partner in a lobbying firm in D.C. and did not relinquish that role. I am a lobbyist. I can tell you that is the definition of conflict of interest. That is corruption on its face. And I think there will ultimately be indictments. So Congress's role here is not these stupid investigations. It's update the ethics law. Let DOJ do their job.
Everybody Google.
Did Elon Musk disclose all of his financial holdings because he was making less than 100? Right? Like, then it's got to be across the board, Bill. Like,
yeah, I'm with that. I'm for transparency, 100%.
Both sides. Everybody Googling Anita Dunn right now because I didn't know that name. All right, after the break, is it Taco Friday? That's be my grab bag.
Yes, it is Friday.
But my grab bag is Taco Friday.
All right.
See what I did there? Kristen, Steve, point taken.
All right. Since we got most of the politics out of our systems, let's finish up with some grab bags.
All right. Joe Zepecki. What is in
I got a fun one this
okay,
week.
Okay, let's hear it.
This is what a baby country we are. Harrison Ruffin Tyler, the last surviving grandson of John Tyler, the 10th president of the United States, died on Sunday at age 96. He was the last of three generations that spanned nearly the entire lifetime of the United States of America. When his grandfather, when President John Tyler was born, George Washington had just become president. Rest in peace, Harrison Tyler. I think it's important to sometimes reflect on just how young a country we are. That's most wild. Of us know our grandparents. Not everybody gets that opportunity, but I just thought that was a neat one to remind folks how young we are in the grand sweep of time.
Historian Joe Zepecki. How about that?
Those are some good genes in that Tyler family.
Yeah, seriously.
Man. All right.
Mine is a hat tip to a couple former Badgers who were inducted into the Badger Hall of Fame this week. The ceremony is later in the summer, but the two are, on the basketball side, it's Frank Kaminsky, who is my favorite Badger of all time. No offense to your father.
Pete. That's your favorite.
Yeah. He got us to two Final Fours, including one national championship game. He changed the Badgers forever, and we're able to recruit so much better since he was here. So, you know, hat tip to Frank Kaminsky. And then the other is my business partner, Joe Pavelski. Joe Pavelski from Plover, Wisconsin, won a state championship at Spash High School. He won a junior A championship for the Waterloo Blackhawks in the USHL. He won a national championship for the Wisconsin Badgers the last time they won it in 2006 right here in Milwaukee. What eluded him throughout his 18-year professional career was a Stanley Cup. He got to the finals twice, was able to go see him play in Pittsburgh one night and in the finals, and he did score a goal that night, but they did not win the series. So Joe had a remarkable career. Many say he's one of the top 10 best American-born players of all time. He also has a silver medal in the Olympics. So hat tip to my good friend and business partner, Joe Pavelski. He owns the Janesville Jets with me, if I haven't said that recently.
You haven't. You've been someone getting away from the hockey references. Big fan of Plover, Wisconsin, by the way.
Yeah.
Right in the center of the state, growing all those potatoes.
Is that where the world's largest potato masher is?
It is.
I think so, yes. And I have relatives that work in that business, so I'm very excited about going up there this summer. All right, so we all heard the taco stuff. Trump always chickens out. I'm going to go take this as a different story. It does ruffle his feathers, to use the chicken term. But what I'm fascinated by, and we talked about this yesterday, and we actually made a post about it. Can reporters...
Lost his mic.
I lost my mic there. Can reporters grow a pair? I mean, why do you just sit there? If he challenges you, him being the president of the United States, come back at him. The worst thing that can happen is they kick you out. Somebody else comes and replaces you. Big deal. So what? Show some whatever. And
backbone.
Yeah, come on. That's how reporting used to work. And this idea that he yells at you, you sort of shrink back in your chair. That's not journalism. Ask the tough questions. If he fires back, you ask an even tougher question that ruffles his damn feathers even more. That's my grab.
Asking someone what they think of taco is not a tough question.
That is not a tough question.
No, it's not.
That's an easy response. It's the first that I'm hearing of this. All right, here's mine. Who wants to take a stab at spelling eclaircissement?
No.
No.
Nope.
Nope, no one? That was the winning word for his name is Faizan Zaki. Who was the runner-up in 2024 for the Scripps National Spelling Bee.
Hey, nice way to come back.
He won this year for the 100th celebration. Eclaircissement.
What does that mean? Yeah, what does that mean?
What does it mean? I just had it up.
E-C-L-A-I-R-I-S-M-E-N-T.
Do it again.
Eclaircissement.
Say it again.
E-C-L-A-I-R-S-I-S-M-E-N-T. Eclaircissement.
I think you got it.
Cissment.
E, but there's a hyphen. Eclaircissement. Did you get it? You missed an
no,
S.
No, I was off by one letter.
They have hyphen words in the...
Not hyphen, apostrophe.
Apostrophe.
Accent. Okay. But it means a clearing up of something obscure.
And credit that Wisconsin kid who finished 10th, by the way. That's pretty impressive, too.
We'll take it.
All right, so we'll do it again next week. I think Bill's going to be off for the week, but Joe Zepecki may be back in studio. Always a great hour with the two smartest gentlemen in the room. Oh, we're not too bad.
You're not
either.
Too bad.
We're fine.
Yeah, Kristen and Steve.
Yeah. We're the better looking ones. It's fine.
Oh, I heard that, Joe, and you hurt my feelings. All right. We'll take a quick break for news. Another hour of Point Taken with Kristen and Steve coming up after the news.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bryan.
All right, the last hour of the week, Steve and I getting into it. What are
I'm
we getting
exhausted.
Into now? We're
going to
be talking about,
week.
Are you?
Yeah. No, not really. It was a short week.
You're exhausted from yesterday because you were moving sod for
moving
6 hours.
Moving sod and moving big trees and bushes, but it all turned out great. My daughter's landscaping project. But you know what? I'm a big fan of the 4-day work week.
I was going to ask. We didn't cover that topic on Tuesday when we came back from the long weekend, and I didn't know how you felt about it. I kind of assumed that you were going to... As a policy, as other countries are exploring, or I think other companies are exploring 4-day work weeks, I kind of thought you would not be a fan.
Yeah, so here's
the classic conservative in you.
Yeah, I know. That's sort of the, yeah. Oh, come on. 5 days a week, 8 hours. Yeah. No, here's my offer. Extra hour Tuesday through Friday, off on Monday.
Oh, for our show?
Yeah. There, it satisfies both things, an extra hour, but also a 3-day
week. So you make Vinny and Eric do 5 hours and the day do 4?
Yeah.
I don't think any of them are going on Monday. Put the best of on Mondays for us.
Whatever.
No, but that actually is an interesting. I mean, I love the idea of a 4-day work week, especially as you look at every productivity assessment of how much more productive we've gotten over the decades, over the last 100 years. So our output is more, and yet we're not working any less. And that was going to be even more so with the inclusion of AI into workflows. So why not have one more day to kind of get your life together?
Here's a prediction. In 20 years, 4-day work weeks will be the norm.
You think so? You think it's coming?
In our country, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, maybe less.
I don't know.
hell with AI and robots, maybe one day
we're such a capitalist society that tries to maximize work and just really wring out every hour of effort that we can from people.
It plays to a lot of different parts of the conversation about where America's at, and one of those is mental health. And I think having a 3-day weekend improves the mental health of this country.
I absolutely agree with that.
Which sort of segues into what we're going to talk about, because you know, I've been reading a lot about the economy and inflation, and you know, we've talked
cost
about
of living,
and purchase of homes. And I don't know where I was at last night looking at something, and I saw the average price of a home in the United States is, I think, $416,000 now. And you've made this point to me on several occasions on several different conversations that it's almost out of reach for a major piece of our population, both in this state and this country.
Not almost is.
Well, I mean, there are still people buying homes, so I mean, you can't say it is out of reach.
No, but for a lot of people, it is.
And you know, I'm looking at some of the notes for the show, and one in four people in this country now saying they're not making a major purchase, including a home or maybe a car or something else really big. And you know, I want to be optimistic, and I see some of the numbers that came out this morning. You know, inflation, you know, is dipping a little bit, which is good. And the numbers in some ways look good. The markets seem to be rebounding, in some ways surpassing the lows of, you know, Liberation Day and beyond. And then I saw, you know, I see the stories that say that there are people struggling in this country still. And I don't know that there's an easy answer for this, but I do know this, and this is sort of why I want to wrap it around from our conversation earlier with Bill and Joe. The idea that we're going to have a different story on tariffs every damn day of the week, so that consumers ultimately, and I just had this conversation on the text exchange, that right now it might not be impacting people, but there's a slow train when it comes to tariffs. We see imports drying up, and we know that's happening because all the ports in the country are seeing less traffic, especially from China. We see less product on the shelves or availability on like the Amazons of the world. That means the supply goes down and the demand will stay strong for a while, but it impacts the prices. And, you know, ultimately inflation will catch hold when we don't have things that we want to buy or things that we do want to buy that we can't afford. That will change the dynamic. So tariffs, this sort of willy-nilly, you know, one day it's on, one day it's off. I said this many times. This will anger all the people who get mad at me when I criticize the president. President doesn't have a basic understanding of what tariffs are or what this sort of back and forth is doing to our country, or probably more importantly, could do. It's dangerous. And you want to screw up our economy, or you want to put us in a recession, I think this is the piece, the tariff back and forth, along with some other really inconsistent policies, is not a good thing. Now, the president would argue, well, the courts are doing this. They're you know, shifting back and forth. It has to be decided at some point, this is what is going to be the rule. And I think Congress has to, this is where the Congress piece steps in, they have to say, this is our responsibility, Mr. President, to set these tariffs, not yours.
But I also feel there's a lot of things being conflated in that, as far as, one, the average home being $400,000 is very expensive, and that has nothing to do with tariffs.
Sure.
I mean, maybe the prices are going to go up because if there's tariffs on lumber and different materials, which is a factor.
New home construction.
But this has been a trend for a while, far as what the average home cost is compared to like what people's wages are, and it being way out of whack from when you first bought your first home, which was what decade?
The 90s. No, before that, 80s.
80s. So yeah, so it's a little different now, as far as I think back in the 80s, it was something like 2 years worth of annual income was basically what a house cost now.
Yeah.
Now it's 4 to 6x of how many years of your annual income, the median annual income buys a house. So that's separate. There is uneasiness and unknowing about the tariffs. And then there's also just interest prices in general. Like I was saying before the show started, I have a friend who's a real estate agent, and I saw him on Wednesday. I go, how's the market right now? And he said, it's still crazy. I mean, he had a $100,000 over asking price in cash get declined.
Yeah, it's
in Milwaukee.
It's insane.
And so I'm like, who is like making an offer that much above asking price with interest rates like this? Like, this is just, it's,
you know,
just
what it
crazy.
Is? The answer to that question is people closer to my age than yours. They're often, they're coming out of a relationship. They're, you know, a split. They have assets. One person's buying a house. One's doing something else. That's in the homes that I know people recently that have bought homes. It's that situation.
That are in their 60s?
No, in their 50s. I said closer to me, not in my actual age. But thanks for pointing out my age again.
You know, you're not ashamed of your age.
I'm 66. Yeah. I'm proud of being 66. I think this is something we're going to have to pay attention to, because as it gets harder and harder for people to have that basic dream, right? It used to be buy a house, you know, raise your family, you know, have the house with the picket fence yard. I don't think anyone puts picket fences up anymore. Very few people. You landscape. You put the
put a badger fence up now.
Yes, badger fence. Thanks. Thanks for that mention. I think we have to pay attention to that. Now, I will say that as someone who was known as a development mayor, we were told when I was leading Oak Creek that people wanted to rent. So we built those units.
But who told you that?
The developers. Which is sort of a bias.
Because when would it ever have been fallen out of favor for people to, I mean, obviously as you're building your life, renting is like a necessity.
You want to know what the anecdotal answer to that is? People who don't want to do yard work.
But then buy a condo. Yeah. Because that's the other thing. Developers basically stop making as many condos.
Yeah. But when you stop building affordable homes, which is what happened for at least a decade. And you want an answer? Start building affordable homes that start about 250.
And also are not massive houses.
Exactly.
That's the thing. Whenever I drive, and then we got to go to break, but like whenever I drive around Milwaukee, Wauwatosa, you know, and thinking about all of the development of these houses in the mid 20th century, and they're very modest houses, right? And it's just like the houses you see built now, like our brand new homes and newer developments, are all just like way too big. Not way too big, but just like a lot bigger than they used to make them.
In the 60s, they built homes that were all 1,500 square feet or lower. Now, yes, the starter homes are 2,100, 2,400, 2,900. That's a significant difference. And the builders will say we can't make money on those. Find a way to make money on a smaller home and build more of them, because that's the answer to the question. We've got to take a break here. Another piece of this story is how people feel about this country and living here. We'll discuss that, Kristen and Steve. Point taken on 620 WTMJ next. You know, Kristen, we're talking about, you know, people trying to make ends meet, trying to buy a house for the first time. Interesting story I found. It's one of my, when I had my own show, I used to do this this piece on Study Finds.
Yeah, you love this site.
I love this site, studyfinds.org, if you want to see what I'm talking about. They have all kinds of different categories, science, wellness, food. But this one has to do with a survey they did. It was Talker Research did a survey about people planning, actually, to move out of country because they don't like it here. 5%, according to this survey, are taking steps to actually move out of the country, live abroad in the next few years. 2% have already started that process. And I actually have met people that have done this on my trips.
Okay. Where'd they move to?
Italy, Tuscany region, two of them.
How hard is it to move to Italy?
Not hard.
You don't have to be, I mean, is this people who are retirement age, so they're not worried about work?
Yeah, they're usually my age. Okay. Yeah, or retirement age, yes. So it's not hard. And here's the we're talking about the cost of homes. It's cheaper to buy property in other countries. Their taxes are often lower, not exclusively, but often lower. Which is sort of weird.
Well, especially because you get so many more services.
Yeah, and you work. And then
I guess you're not paying for the military.
Yeah, maybe that's it. And their food's better. Cost of living is much cheaper. And I've said this before.
You're talking yourself into it.
Well, my plan is to do it a couple months a year. Probably not going to relocate to Italy, although Tuscany calls me every day. Well, maybe Scotland will call me because it'll be...
The weather in Scotland. You can't convince Kathy of that.
Yeah, the growing. I don't think I can grow tomatoes up there very well.
I have no idea.
So that would be a negative. But I'm curious about this because I think it shows that there's still, as optimistic as some of us are about this country, there's a group of people saying, you know what, I'm not liking where this country's going. And I think that's something we got to pay attention to.
I would say almost all of my friends who are in marriages where one of the spouses is not American, they have very serious conversation about leaving the country.
Yeah.
So I have friends who, one is Australian and the other is American. For now, they live in San Diego. And I think realistically, they will probably end up in Australia. Another friend who, she's British and he's American. And they often talk about moving to the UK. And for them, a big reason is they have small children and they're worried about guns.
Yeah. I mean,
like that becomes a very big part of the calculation is like, sending your kids to school here and just how scary that is these days.
It's interesting on that topic of guns that there's two extreme sides, right? One that says more guns. The other one says, what are we doing here? And we never have any really reconciliation of those two extreme ideas. If anything that makes sense, given the rules of the land of America, right? Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. And the reality that we face every day when people are being killed for no real reason other than the fact there was a gun handy and they decided to, you know, blow someone's brains out. I mean, that's the confounding thing about what I thought used to be the genius of this country, why I worked for at least 10 years on gun violence. I don't get it. With rights comes responsibilities, and this idea that we don't have to think about that, we should think about it every damn day, because people shouldn't die for no reason, and that shouldn't be your first recourse is to pick up a gun.
Because I would say the other thing is certainly healthcare, and that at any point you get sick, and you know, it could be a sentence to be like going bankrupt. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things we're not crushing it on. I know yesterday you were still very gung-ho on it being the best country in the world. And I still think that. I asked you for how to measure that, because I would say there's other countries that are the quality of living for the average person, it's much higher.
And I was thinking about this last night, because you asked me that question yesterday, and I used to say opportunity. But when you see people who come here to learn now being turned away, often the brightest minds in the world, who can't come and study here because they don't, you know, they're not from here. They're others. That sort of removes that piece.
But there's also been a plateauing of generations doing better than their parents.
Yes.
Right. So there is not the same upward mobility that there once was for people like boomers, as far as the much more likely to stay in the same class of which you were born.
Yeah, you know, we have to get on the show as a generational expert that looks at all the distinctions between the classes, but actually takes that
generations,
and then takes that information and makes sense of it for us.
Data visualization expert.
Yes. Wow, you just pull it out of your hat?
What?
What did you call it?
Nothing.
Data visualization.
Data visualization very expert.
Impressive. All right, we got to take a break here. Lots more to get to on the remaining 40 minutes or so, 35 minutes. Don't forget, bottom of the hour news coming up with Connie Weber and, of course, ABC, but we got to take a break here. Oh, Krista, you know I'm going to Hawaii in November of 26. Yes.
I did not.
Fox World Travel.
It's the first I'm hearing of this.
866-GO-FOX-GO. First you're hearing of it, really. Mm. Now, if you wanted to go, you could probably go, but you'd have to pay.
I'd have to pay, but I also, who's going to do the show? Well, I got to man the ship.
We get somebody to fill in.
No, that's the new rule.
New rule.
We can't take off the same days.
We were chatting during a break about, you know, other than like the Pearl Harbor thing, which is a really important part of this trip. And I'd love to have you join me. We only have, I think, like 14 spots left. So you better sign up quick because they're going to sell out soon. And we're like way in advance of when we're actually going on the trip. I'm actually looking forward to the luau. I've never been to a luau.
Well, why would you have ever gone to a luau if you've never been to Hawaii?
I don't know. Don't they do them as like fun party things around the...
I mean, there's like a luau themed thing,
yes.
But it's like
I've never been to anything
luau.
Like that. What
I feel like you got to do it in Hawaii.
You told me you had been to a luau on
Yeah, so there was... I was at the opportunity. We got to travel because my dad worked for Merrill Lynch, and so there was always like, you know, oh, you hit a certain amount of sales or whatever. And so we were really lucky growing up, and I got to go to Hawaii a couple times as a kid. And then there was a basketball tournament, because when we lived in Los Angeles, my dad coached for Brentwood High School, and there was a basketball tournament in Hawaii. But it's been almost 20 years since I've been there.
All right, so what goes on at these luaus?
There's performers, mm-hmm. And so there's dancers, there's like fire breathers, there's obviously hula dancers, they always roast a pig.
Which I like.
There's a lot of tiki torches.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like a party.
Yeah, so our group are going to have our own luau.
Great, that's awesome.
I'm looking forward to that.
Are you going to hula dance?
Probably not. I'm not a dancer. I'm a singer.
You don't dance with Kathy?
If she asks me to, I will, yes.
Okay.
Because that's the right thing to do. But I want to sell this trip out so we can start planning our pre-trip party that we always do. We put everything together in like a...
Are you guys doing the Road to Hana?
I think so.
That's fun.
Yeah.
So you'll see in some incredible beaches. We did that, and there's a black sand beach with just the smoothest stones you'll ever remember. So I don't have the time for the story.
All right, we can get it next time because I'm going to talk about it every day
for
a while. Best of the Hawaiian Islands with yours truly. It's November 9th through the 19th next year, next November, 866 Go Fox Go or foxworldtravel.com. Group vacations. Easy to find. After the break, interesting topic that you threw into the old mix.
Movie incentives.
Yeah.
Both in Texas and in Wisconsin.
I feel like we were talking about the movies that yesterday or the day before, and then Bill brought up Mission Impossible in one of the breaks, which I do want to see.
What movie was I talking about?
I don't remember now.
With Lilo and Stitch?
Yes, Lilo and Stitch. Yeah. What context was that?
The record weekend, yeah.
Yeah, that was on Tuesday.
Yes.
After our long weekend.
Yes. All right, so I thought this was interesting.
It is interesting.
Because it kind of ties back to Wisconsin as well. But not only are they considering it, but it just passed the Senate. So Texas lawmakers, there was a bill championed by Texas natives, Taylor Sheridan of Yellowstone fame. Actually, he's like the new Shonda Rhimes. He's got a million different shows out there.
He's a billionaire now.
Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey.
All right.
So the original bill would offer $1.5 billion, billion with a B, incentives to attract TV, film, and video game production to Texas. But the bill... And I'm trying to find, so I just checked, and yesterday it passed the Senate, so now this bill is moving forward to Governor Abbott's desk, but it ended up being about $300 million per year, every 2 years, until 2035. The original bill was asking for $500 million every 2 years, so it's probably a little bit shy of that $1.5 billion. But this is what I need to go research now, because when they were talking about this is what I thought was interesting. The strings attached to the bill were that any work that's made in Texas under the incentive would not be able to portray Texas negatively.
Okay, that's just stupid. So
what? Who is the arbiter of that? Who gets to decide what
is or
is not portraying? Can you not make any jokes about Texas? So, like in Yellowstone, did you watch the show?
I know of the show.
So there's a character on Yellowstone, who's a ranch hand, and it's a woman. And so most of the ranch hands are they're kind of nomads, but she's the one from Texas, and she has an almost indecipherable accent. Trying to listen to her speak is just like, I'm sorry, what? It's like trying to listen to characters in the movie Snatch.
Yeah.
Like Brad Pitt's character.
Yeah.
So it's like, is that in making fun of Texas accents? Is that portraying Texas negatively? Or is it like who would decide that?
I have no idea. And it's sort of an interesting concept. So yes, you can make a movie here, but it's got to be positive about what we're doing. How do you do a story about a mass murder? And last time I checked, a lot of mass murderers grew up in Texas, or at least come from
a lot of serial killers from Wisconsin too. So that's a question.
Okay. So you can't do the Ed Gein story from,
which that's already happened. I think it's out. Is it the new one? The monster series? Yes. Is it out?
It's been done numerous times.
Well, no, I know, but there's a new one in it's the third chapter, yes, of the Netflix series. Cause they did Dahmer. They did the Mendez brothers, right, and then they were doing Ed Gein.
Yeah. And Plainfield, Wisconsin.
Two out of three in Wisconsin.
Would like to forget that story. And of course the Dahmer story still lives on. And our friend Eddie Schwartz is, probably written the definitive book on that. I don't see how you can do that. Possibly do that. You can't limit the freedom to cover a story or to report a story in context of a movie. So unless you have some specific rules about the types of movies, maybe, I don't know.
Let's apply it to Wisconsin. So if people wanted to, because we're going to come back and talk about the status of this Wisconsin incentives. But what could you or could you not do? Like, of the things that were supposed to be taking place in Wisconsin, so if we think of that 70s show, how many of those jokes would have to be cut as far as poking fun at Wisconsin?
Well, just the accent itself is...
They didn't have any... I feel like on that show they didn't do the accents very much.
No, they didn't. They didn't try. But there are accents.
Same thing with the Jon Stewart movie when they did... That came out in 2020. That was kind of a bomb. But their accents were... They didn't even say Wisconsin correctly.
No.
No. Can you think of, so what else?
In a negative sense?
Yeah, what would be the line for...
Well, probably anything that depicts us as drunken, weekenders.
But there's a lot of people who enjoy that image of us. A lot of people who take a lot of pride in that.
There are people that still, on Facebook, I just saw this recently, still take pride in the fact that we have the drunkest counties in the country, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
And we're the drunkest state. Like, why are you hanging your... So that kind of a depiction would probably not be welcome if our state indeed... Went
has
down
an,
this path.
An office, a film office.
I know we're going to talk about this next segment. We're actually trying to do this.
I hope we do.
We had the guest on your show.
So let's take a break quickly, and we'll come back and kind of give an update for where we are of potentially bringing film incentives back to Wisconsin. But if you have an idea, what would be the line for Wisconsin if we were to let give incentives for films and TV shows to be filmed here? What could they not do or say about Wisconsin if we had that same rule as Texas? So stay with us. Oh, 855-616-1620. Stay with us. This is Point Taken.
Lots of good texts today. People are responding to our movie locale. Should it be in Wisconsin? What would be the things that they shouldn't
could
talk
or
about?
Could not say?
Yeah. We got a call. You want to take a call?
Sure.
From my favorite city. Steve from Oak Creek, welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. And if you're going to be filming in Wisconsin, then you must say something negative about Illinois.
That's fair. I think that is a good one to bake in there.
Yeah, I think that's a good... Any other suggestions before we send you off into the world of the day? That's it. That's all you got, Steve. You weren't quick enough, buddy. I gave you the opportunity, and you didn't seize it. Seize the day.
All right, well, when you filled in with me a couple... This was in April, I want to say.
Yeah.
We spoke to Suzanne Gerva and Nathan Deming, who are both part of Action. Action! Wisconsin, and I say it like that because there's
I forgot to wear my t-shirt
point,
today they gave me.
In the group's name. But at that point, there had been Governor Evers' budget had been proposed, and he had a film office and tax incentives in his budget. Since then, there actually has been a bipartisan bill introduced in the Senate and the Assembly talking about this as well. So maybe, just maybe, we might be getting closer to seeing some movies brought back to being filmed in Wisconsin. To me, this feels like a no-brainer.
Remember, wasn't Dillinger a lot of that filmed in
a lot of that a lot of that was filmed here.
Johnny Depp.
But you see, I mean, so here are some of the numbers as far as you just were asking me this, and it's a good plug for our You Need to Listen podcast because you guys, does it really count when Top Chef? Set to count as it still counts under the umbrella of making TV and movies here. They're filming on location. There's crew that gets wages and people like
It does fall under the umbrella of reality TV. I will stomach that one because it's about food.
No, but I'm saying you're asking like why would it if it would qualify
if that
for
number's
incentives?
Right, 4 million, absolutely, it does qualify.
But so the point being that the crew's 2 month stay resulted in hotel night stays generating $4 million, and so that doesn't even include the food and stuff that they were doing as far as an economic boost. And then we now see people are now coming to Wisconsin because they saw it on Top Chef in Georgia, which has a thriving film industry. There was a 2023 study that found for every dollar invested in film and television incentives, there was a $6.30 economic benefit.
Yeah, it's real. That's why I support the Action effort. Okay. And if it is truly bipartisan, let's get it done. What's the problem here?
I don't know.
Evers, LeMahieu, Voss, et al., get it done. What's the problem? It's not that difficult. Now, I will say this about the Top Chef stuff. This is my critique. We love when they come here and show us in our environment. Like, we love that the draft was here and, hey, Green Bay, blah, blah, blah. We tend to glamorize that. And there's always this hometown piece that always just makes me sick at some point. We're so proud. It just gets overdone. Just celebrate they're here. You don't have to keep doing it every damn day for, like, weeks and weeks after they're gone already. It was done well. Let's move on. Let's move on to the next thing. I don't want...
What are you talking about? Who are you referencing?
The fascination we have with Top Chef and our local, the local participants. Yeah, they're great. Dan, great restaurant. Loved all that stuff. But here's the problem. It's kind of like the same story with 82 Brewers. We're still talking about that damn thing. Move on. And we're still talking about Top Chef.
I feel like we talk about it in the context of, look at how this was a net positive across the board.
It was a positive.
And this is why we should invest in doing trying to attract more things like that to come here.
We need more. That's why this is a good idea, but we need more.
So I feel like it's used as a reference point, not as a, oh, the good old days.
Good old days. Remember when Top Chef was here?
Reliving our high school glory.
Exactly. Glory days, a la Bruce Springsteen.
I feel like that's very different than the 82 Brewers.
I don't think so.
It also is much more recent than the 82 Brewers.
It's definitely more recent, but it's this fixation we have on just, oh my God, they were here in Wisconsin.
I also don't feel like I've really heard anyone talk about the draft since the draft has been over.
Do you listen to sports radio at
all? No.
Oh, you should.
Why?
Because they talk about the draft still.
That does not feel like a very compelling reason to listen to sports radio.
Well, there's a lot of reasons not to and a lot of reasons to listen to sports radio. Because you want to hear about bad takes? Listen to sports radio. God bless them, the folks that do it, but it's the worst of bad takes.
You think any of them say that about you?
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Do you think any of those guys listen to us?
Oh, I know they do. Yeah. Alex, what's his last name?
Strouth.
He listens.
To the show or to the podcast?
Probably the podcast because he's busy during the day. But he does listen. Somebody said we don't want to hear about cheeseheads in any of the product, which is also a thing that we do.
All right, if we don't want to hear about, this is the thing. Who is the arbiter of this? Because you don't want to hear about cheeseheads, and yet there are some people, no matter what the international event is, whether it's the Olympics last summer, that was last summer, or when I was in Brazil for the Packers game, there are people who will travel with their cheesehead and wear it proudly at these events. And those are not easy things to pack. Those don't compress nicely into you're making room in your limited space in your suitcase to be able to pack and wear that cheesehead. So some people, I think, would have a problem with that.
Let me wrap this all together in a nice little, with a little bow on it. The only time I've ever worn a cheesehead in my life was at the time when I attended the draft in Las Vegas. And I was in the inner sanctum, and they gave us cheeseheads because we were on TV a lot. That's the only time I've ever worn a cheesehead. And I was proud to wear it there because that was for some reason. But we're fixated on ourselves for all the dumb reasons that people are fixated on themselves.
I need to look back and see if I have a screenshot of you on TV.
I'll send you.
Because I want to make that your contact photo in my phone.
No, you are not doing that. Jeez, Kristen, we're having too much fun on this Friday. Oh, it's Friday.
It's Friday. We can have fun.
This is the day to have fun because this is going to be a good weekend. I'm going to have this one. I know we're late for break. I'm going to have at least two cigars this weekend.
Oh. What's the deciding factor if you're going to have a third?
Probably not three.
Okay.
Just, one this afternoon, one tomorrow afternoon. Sunday, I got a lot of stuff to do. Going out to dinner twice.
Ooh.
Yeah. Hey, Papa Luigi's in Cudahy, I will be there tonight. And my friend who you've met, Chef Fecker, I'll be at his restaurant,
nice.
Il Mito, tomorrow night.
Right. We'll talk about my weekend plans on the other side of this.
Yeah. You got some?
I do.
All right. That's all coming up on the big show. Point taken. 620 WTMJ. Oh, yeah. Welcome back. 11:54, 620 WTMJ. She's Chris and I'm Steve. Smooth jazz on this Friday afternoon. How y'all doing out there? What are you doing this weekend, Chris?
We have the big Locust Street Festival this weekend on Sunday, including the beer run, which still has 66 spots open.
And you're not running.
I'm not running. I am pouring beer. So,
interesting.
This is a Swarm event. So Swarm is my husband's company.
Yeah.
So the Locust Street Beer Run, it's a 46th annual. It's a 1.6-mile run through the streets of River West.
How long is the run?
1.6 mile. It's like
that's
then.
Easy. It's a short
and
run.
So there's four different beer stops.
Which one are you at?
At the first one.
Okay.
So I'll be up there pouring beers.
So people can actually have you pour their beer.
Yes, yes.
Will you engage with them?
It's a race, so it depends on how fast you're running. If you're not trying to be
If they're slow, they want to just chat.
Yeah, they are. Well, because there's some people walk it, some people run it, some people walk it.
Any strollers?
A lot of strollers. I think Jeremy Janine won the stroller division last year.
Okay.
It's an unofficial title, but he was the first one. He thinks he was the first one to finish while also pushing a stroller.
Nice.
So that is, if you want to still register for that, it starts at 11:30. If you go to locuststreetfestival.org/beer run, you can register for that. So that'll be really fun. And then the rest of the day is the festival on Locust Street, which is always really fun.
I've never been to that.
Do you want to come?
I can. I'm busy. Sunday, right?
That's Sunday.
Yeah. I'm going to be in Illinois.
And the weather's going to be beautiful.
It's supposed
Which
to be like 70.
Always helps.
Yeah, sunny.
Yeah. So
well,
that's
good job. It's always nice when the weather cooperates with this outdoors because having your husband, you know how important that is.
I do. He hates the thing he hates more. Like Mark Baden, one of the nicest humans you're ever going to meet.
Superhuman
right?
being.
And every time there's a live event, he's involved also. He does Storm the Bastille for Bastille Days. and there's ever the like insinuation and the scare, as he calls them, scare tactics, that a storm is coming,
yeah,
and then it doesn't actually come, he just curses those people, including Mark Baden,
because they're planting that seed.
Yeah, he's like, you're ruining this. This, yeah. It didn't even rain, and now no one's here.
Well, they're saying that today it's going to rain, but I'm looking at this weather map of the state, and there's like nothing. So pop-up showers is what they call it.
Yeah. I actually might go to a farmer's market tomorrow, too.
Those are always fun.
I don't know which one I will go to, but I'm going to... Tis the season.
There's a lot of good ones, including Oak Creek, Drexel Town Square, every Saturday morning. And they have great popcorn popped right there.
Oh.
Oh, my God. It's like theater popcorn. I love it. All right, great week of shows, shortened week. Again, big fan of the four-day work week, so I'll throw that offer out there. We'll do an extra hour 4 days a week. Kristen, have a great weekend.
You too.
Happy bartending. Happy whatever I'm going to be doing.
Happy cigars.
Yeah, happy cigar day. I just looked at them. They're ready to smoke. All right, a quick break for news, and then, of course, the midday show. Who knows what they're going to talk about? Find out after the news on 620 WTMJ.